Well, we are joined on the telephone now by Professors Ruth Ann and Paul Atchley. They are at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, where she is the chair of the Department of Psychology, and he is the director of the Cognitive Psychology Program. Welcome.
Hi, well, thank you.
Thanks, you both, for being here. We've interviewed hundreds of people on this program, but I'm not sure we've ever had husband and wife professors before.
People aren't used to it.
How does that work out for you guys?
Actually, it works beautifully. We understand each other, and not many people understand the craziness that is psychology professor.
Oh, that's great. I actually, in a past life, did a year of a PhD program in psychology.
You're one of us?
Yeah. Kind of. So anyway, the reason we wanted to talk with you is I ran across this interesting article saying that you had done some research along with a professor from the University of Utah, showing that backpackers scored 50% better on a creativity test after spending 4 days in nature disconnected from electronic devices. How did you get the idea to do this research?
Go ahead, Paul. This is yours. You started us off.
Well, my area of research is on distractions. I look at why people choose to do crazy things like text and drive. And our colleague Dave Strayer at the University of Utah does a lot of this work, too. And we're really interested in why technology has oftentimes negative effects on us. And one of the things we've all noticed is that as people like to get into the outdoors, we seem to just be energized, think more clearly, generally more creative when we're outdoors. And so we thought this might be something interesting to study.
Mm-hmm. And so describe the study. How did you do it? What did you look at?
Well, I had done some research on creativity before and sort of why people are creative and creativity in the brain. And so Paul and Dave asked me for a good task that we could do in the wild, out in nature. And we used a tool that's been around really since the 60s that's been well established as a measure of creativity. And we did something quite simple. We went out on a backpacking trip, a small group of us, and we looked to see if there seemed to be some change in our ability to respond creatively if we had been in nature for a while. And we found a big effect with just a small group. So that's when we got excited and started doing the work with Outward Bound.
Mm-hmm. And so what describe the results?
Well, it's about as simple as you can get. I mean, science is rarely simple, but this one was. If a person's been out in nature for 4 days, what we found is literally a 50% increase in your ability to be creative when you're given this kind of word puzzle that is a test of good verbal creativity.
And what do you attribute that result to? I know, Paul, you'd mentioned distraction and electronic devices and so forth, but what are your thoughts about why this is so?
Well, we've got lots of different possibilities, and we're going to try to nail those down with some additional work. Ruth Ann and I actually probably come at this from a slightly different direction because she does work on depression and emotion and threat, and I do work on distraction. My take on it is that the kinds of devices we're constantly using to distract us, like phones, smartphones, the internet, all these other sorts of things, are really grabbing our attention in a way that doesn't help our thinking process. Imagine Thoreau in his little cabin in the woods trying to write, and suddenly his iPhone goes off. He's probably not going to be all that creative. So I think that these distractions are actually, in a sense, kind of making us dumber.
Interesting.
And then I come at it from a little different perspective, like Paul said, because for me, what I see when I see these same devices, and I look at the sort of world that we all live in, there's all these sources of sort of threat and things that try to capture our attention. And so if you think about it, if a phone ring is effective, it's grabbing you and making you sort of redirect what you're doing. And it's doing that because you're either, I want to grab that thing because I want to talk to somebody or something bad could be happening. And all of those have emotional significance. They matter to you emotionally. And all of these sort of different emotional cues, I know from my research in depression, can in effect be sort of fatiguing, and they can change your mood,
mm-hmm.
so that you're literally less happy.
And you're kind of on alert.
Yeah, exactly. That it's an alert signal. That's exactly what it is. Well put.
Okay.
And so what I think we've done is created a world of alert signal.
Huh. Interesting.
That are really constantly demanding our both mental as well as emotional resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know one of the articles I was reading about this cited something called attentional restoration theory.
Right.
Can you explain that in for the layperson?
Sure. So the idea is that normal everyday environments, especially these technological environments we live in, are constantly depleting our attentional resources. Everyone's experienced this, especially if you've lived in an area where you have to commute, or you work in an environment where you're constantly having to multitask and do lots of different things. You feel tired at the end of the day. You know, even though you may not have physically done anything, your brain feels fatigued. And the problem is that your attention is constantly being grabbed. You constantly have to change the way that you think. The idea behind attentional restoration theory is that nature helps restore those resources that have been depleted. Now, a lot of people want to use television to restore resources. You want to just, quote, veg out in front of the TV. But the problem is TV isn't restorative. There's constant, you know, commercials, jump edits, loud music, loud things to grab your attention and keep you focused. That's not restorative. But anyone that's been out in the boundary waters, for example, and has just sat and listened to loons, knows that if you're just sitting there at night and just sort of paying attention to nature, it attracts enough of your attention, you have to sort of be engaged, but not so much that it's stressing you out, and you feel relaxed. You have that moment where you just go, ah. Mm-hmm. And that restoration is good for your brain. So attention restoration theory says that nature helps give us back the resources that all these other things are taking away from us.
So perhaps it is not coincidental that our community here, Grand Marais, is while it's on the edge of Lake Superior and the Boundary Waters Wilderness, is also a huge arts community, and we have so many creative people here.
Absolutely, I actually don't think that's coincidental. And when I think about it, there's another phrase that comes from that same area of research, and they talk about it as soft fascination. And I bet the folks who are listening totally know what I mean as soon as I say it. It's this idea of, you know, nature being interesting, but mildly positive and not demanding. You know, I think one of the things we don't really make a distinction of is the difference between demanding, you know, that sort of alerting, versus fascinating, engaging, but at the same time, relaxing and restorative. And what we think we found is scientific evidence that kind of more soft fascination has a restorative effect on how well we think.
We're speaking with Professors Ruth Ann and Paul Atchley. They are both psychology professors at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, and they recently completed some research where they discovered that backpackers scored 50% better on a creativity test after spending 4 days in nature disconnected from electronic devices. I wanted to ask you about what you're seeing with college students, actually, and electronic devices, and how you think that that's affecting learning and creativity.
That's a great question, and I talk a lot with my college students about this. Our entire class the other day turned into this discussion. I mean, it's a problem, and they know it. We have a class here at the University of Kansas in the journalism department where they actually have their students go on a media fast for 24 hours, and you wouldn't believe the quotes that you get from these people that are having to give up media for 24 hours. And actually, I've got this presentation up. I was just giving it to students the other day. They have quotes like, "It showed me my cell phone and computer were basically my best friends. You know, I felt like I was completely disconnected from the world around me. I felt like I had lost all contact with my friends, even though I'd only been 3 hours that I had gone without talking to them through media. My day phoneless and computerless and musicless almost made me feel handicapped." I mean, they're realizing, especially when they disconnect, that the world's not right, that they're not reacting normally when they're having to interact with these devices. And one of the things in this study that we did that was really fascinating, the writer for Backpacker Magazine that chronicled this, Elizabeth Quack Heffernan, said, you know, when the young adults would go out on this trip at the beginning, they would kind of freak out because they couldn't have their cell phones. But after a couple of weeks, when they came back, they would say things like, I really don't want to go back. I don't want to have to reconnect and feel like I have to constantly use all these things all the time. I think they understand how twisted these devices have made the way in which we interact with the world. And frankly, the students I talked to just a couple of days ago are worried about it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that in some ways it's almost an addictive kind of thing.
Actually, that's funny. Paul's been doing research.
We just published a different study on the addiction aspect.
Please talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Well, it's a complex study. It used a technique from behavioral economics called delay discounting. The idea is, how long can you wait to do something? If you're addicted to something, you don't want to wait to get that thing you're addicted to. You're willing to give up something to get it right away. And so we presented people with choices. You, for example, you could either, you've been away for a week, you get a text from your girlfriend that says, text me back when you can, and you can text right away and get $50, or you can wait some period of time, like a couple of hours, and you'll get $100. What kind of choice do you make? And if someone's addicted, they're not really willing to wait very long. And what we found was that basically, people were willing to give up 50% of a monetary reward to not have to wait more than about 20 minutes to text someone back.
Wow.
Now, if it's just money by itself without that texting attached to it, they're willing to wait really a couple of months to get a larger monetary reward. So it looks like these rewards have a lot of value, but we wouldn't classify it as addiction, because they were willing to wait some period of time, and more importantly, they could discriminate between different types of messages. Yeah, they wanted to text their girlfriend back right away, but if it was just a friend or an acquaintance, they were willing to put off that text for a considerable amount of time. So we say it's more of a compulsion than an addiction, but it's certainly for those of us that don't text constantly, an unusual level of compulsion.
Interesting. Well, now you mentioned that you are going to be doing further research on the nature and creativity link. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're hoping to actually understand a lot of different pieces of this. I mean, one of the things from my perspective is sort of what is the nature not just doing to how you behave, but what it also does to your brain and your body. I'm a neuroscientist by training, and so we're hoping to look at brain responses in natural environments to see how those differ from people who are in, in the normal everyday environment. We're going to be looking at people's responses to emotional stimuli, how they respond, how they attend. But the other thing we want to do is also look at some other things that are physiological markers of stress, and how your body is sort of able to respond to stress and emotional kinds of things. So, you know, we're going to be getting more at the physiology than just the behavior is one of the directions that we're likely to go. And then we also need to just get more different kinds of tasks so that we know that it's not just about this one tool we used, but that we know with lots of different tools and measures of thinking that we still see an advantage.
Okay, well, it sounds very interesting, and I'm looking forward to reading more about that when it comes out. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we let you go?
I would add that people in your listening area should understand how so lucky they are to live where they live, because these types of environments are becoming fewer and further between, and take advantage of every moment that you can spend outside.
That's true.
And the other thing I would just sort of ask people to do is make sure they're paying attention to what their kids are doing with their time as well. I mean, to me, getting into this research, one of the most disturbing things was how little time kids spend out of doors. And so one of the directions we want to go is to start working with school systems and try to think about getting kids outside more as a way of helping restore all the things they need to be able to be effective learners.
Well said. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us tonight. Fascinating subject
and
very worthwhile research. We appreciate it.
All righty. Thank you.
Thank you.